Welcome to The Positioning Show, where we discuss topics related to the practical application of positioning for marketing, sales, and product teams. I'm April Dunford, a consultant, author, and the world's leading expert on positioning for B2B technology companies. Hi, welcome back. Hey, everybody. I haven't seen you in so long. What's going on? How are you feeling? How's everything going? Hey, this is episode one of season two of Positioning with April Dunford, and you might be thinking, what the heck? I thought that thing was done already. And you know what? It kind of was. And now we have a season two surprise. I wanted to talk a little bit about this before I kicked off season two. So when I started this podcast, and that was back June last year, maybe, when I started, I had two or three goals I wanted to accomplish. So the first one was I had been doing a lot of guesting on other people's podcasts, which was really fun. And I got a lot of positive feedback from that. So I thought, hey, podcasting is good. But one of the things that frustrated me was that in every new podcast, there was a new audience. And so we kind of had to start back with the basics of positioning. Like, what is positioning? What does good positioning look like? What does bad positioning look like? Give me a couple examples, April. And then by the time we got through that, we kind of ran out of time for the rest of the podcast. So I found it a little bit frustrating that, one, I felt like I was answering the same questions over and over again. And two, I thought some people are out there listening to me on multiple podcasts and they've got questions that go deeper than this. And I'm never really getting a chance to go deeper than that in a podcast medium. So I thought, you know what? If I could do my own podcast, then I could have solo episodes where I pick a topic that I get asked about a lot and I can go really deep on that. And for people that are interested in that, this would be a neat resource. So that was the thinking about it originally. The second thing was that I had never done a podcast of my own before. So as a marketer, I thought, well, this would be really fun to actually learn the medium, learn the channel, mess around with that, see how it looks, get a chance to track the numbers where you see your own numbers and not just hearing the numbers from other people. So I thought that would be fun. And then the third thing was I thought it might be good for business. So I know that a lot of my customers listening to podcasts, I had people call me after I was a guest on a podcast and say, hey, I heard you as a guest on a podcast. And then I read your book and then I came to you. So I thought, hey, this would be a good resource for people that want to go deep on this stuff. And there'll be some number of those people that call me up and say, April, I'd like to hire you to help with my positioning or my sales pitch or whatever. So those were the original three goals. Did I meet the goals? Well, yeah, I kind of. The first one, I ended up doing 26 episodes. The vast majority of those were solo episodes with just me. I had a handful of guests on and I thought all my guests were really, really great. So I was pleased with that. I learned a lot about podcasting and some of it good and some of it bad. I really like the idea of being able to fire up a camera and just riff on stuff. I find that really fun. I think it's good for my own thinking on some of these topics to be able to just talk about stuff and go deeper on it. It was really fun for me to go deeper on some of these topics that I didn't get a chance to ever talk about on anybody else's podcast. So that was really, really fun. Did the podcast drive any business? I've had a lot of people ask that question. And the answer is it's been bad for lead generation, but good in other ways. So I thought that I would get people listen to the podcast, think it was interesting, go read the book, call me. And that didn't happen. But what did happen was a lot of the companies that hired me sent my podcast around to folks on the team that were actually going to be in a positioning sales pitch workshop. And folks listened to the podcast in advance to be prepared for the workshop once I got there, which is actually kind of awesome. So the last, I would say, two dozen workshops that I've done, folks have come in and said, hey, we listened to your podcast. This was so great. I have a question about this thing. Or when we would get to a particular point in the workshop, people would come up and say, hey, when, you know, I know you're saying this, but I heard you say this other thing on your podcast. So why is this different? And I thought, man, this is so cool. Like, I'm dealing with folks that are really well educated at this point. And that's kind of cool. The other thing you get is you show up and half the people in the room are like, why are you talking so slow? Because they've been listening to me on double speed on the podcast. Anyways, yeah, I don't know what I think about that. But that's that. So at the end of season one, I think I did 26 episodes. I kind of felt like I did what I needed to do. Like I was running out of things to talk about. I had done all of the big topics that I was hoping to go deep on. And I kind of felt like, you know what? We're at the end here. We came, we saw, we did it, we're done. So why do a season two? Two reasons. One, I had a couple of guests that I wanted to get in on season one. And because they have schedules and I have schedules, we didn't actually end up recording in time to make season one. So that was one thing. So I had a couple of episodes that I had recorded that I didn't actually get a chance to release. And so I thought I should release those because they're really good. The second thing was that occasionally, since it's been 2 months now since I've dropped a new podcast, occasionally I would have a topic come up while I was working with a client or talking to a CEO that I would think, oh, that would be a really good topic to cover as a solo episode on the podcast. So here's what's going to happen. I decided we are going to do season two. It's going to be different than season one. I think it's going to be a bit more of a podcast where I have guests, although I'm still not totally committed to the idea of a guesting podcast. I really want to stay focused on my core topics, which are positioning and how we operationalize positioning. So you're still going to get that in this podcast. So if I bring a person on, you can be pretty much guaranteed that we're going to cover that topic. I'm not going to start going super broad and bringing people on just because I think they're interesting people. We're going to bring people on so that we can go deep on a specific topic. And you're still going to get solo episodes from me. I don't think I'm going to do this weekly anymore. I'm super busy right now. And like I said, I think I've covered a lot of the topics I already needed to cover. It's not every week that I have something that I need to talk about. So I think what we're going to do instead is every other week. It might even come a bit more sparsely than that. So you can be guaranteed that when a topic does come up and you see a new episode come up, it's because I got something good to talk about, not because I think I got to get one of these out every week. So that's it. A couple of things I want to say. One is, you people are amazing. Like I have 116 reviews on this podcast. And you know what? I read every single one and they make me very, very happy. Sometimes you feel like you're shouting into the void with some of this content and you're not sure whether people think it's useful or not useful. And a lot of you have written reviews to tell me that it is useful. And that's great. I can tell you there would not be a season two of this if I didn't have that level of encouragement. So anyways, thanks a lot. So let's get into it. You know, today I thought I would cover something that I have covered previously on my newsletter. You know, I have a newsletter, right? aprildenford.substack.com, or you go on my website and click on the thing that says newsletter. You can sign up and get it. It magically appears in your inbox. One of the topics I covered there recently is why positioning fails to make the jump from marketing to sales, which is something that I see a lot in the clients that I work with. And I thought, hey, that'd be a fun topic to cover on the podcast. So let's get into it. What I've seen in a lot of companies is that marketing, the marketing team in general, really deeply understands positioning. They understand the concept. They understand that it's important. And they're sweating it. Like, and in particular, they're sweating copy a lot. Like precisely what do we say on the website? Precisely what do we say in campaigns? Are we expressing our value the right way? And they're just like fine-tuning that stuff like you would not believe. And then what happens? We generate some leads. And at some point, this lead gets passed over to the sales team. And what happens in sales? Absolutely no positioning is going on over there at all. It's super, super common. It gets to sales. And what sales is doing is kind of a product walkthrough. We're just showing all the features, just the facts, Jack. We're not actually trying to position anything. And it's curious, like, why doesn't that positioning manage to make the jump from marketing to sales? And I've worked with a lot of companies, like, I don't know, it's been 250, 300 companies, something like that now. And so I have opinions about this. I think there are a common set of misconceptions or things that we get wrong when we're doing positioning work that makes it hard for things to make the jump. So I'm going to dive into that. The first misconception that I see is that there's this idea that a sales pitch needs to be completely customized for every prospect. And when I say a sales pitch, I mean there is a belief that every conversation we have with the customer should be completely customized. Now, let's dig into that a little bit. What does a typical lead flow look like in a B2B software tech company? Typically, what happens is there's some sort of lead generation mechanism, whatever that might be. And before the lead makes it to a sales rep for a first call, typically there's some kind of light qualification happens. Now, that can happen in a lot of different ways. Some folks do this with forms or questionnaires. Some folks do this with, you know, the product itself does it. So we're looking at the behavior of people in the product and what they do. A lot of times, though, how it actually gets done is there's an inside sales team, and the inside sales team will do this light qualifications, really fast call. And it's like, hey, we just got to ask you a few questions, and we want to make sure that you're a good fit for our stuff and we're a good fit for you, and we don't want to waste anybody's time. So we will do this late qualification. And that qualification is macro stuff. You know, how big is the company? And sometimes they'll get into things like, you know, budget and are you the right person? There might be some things like, you know, do you have the right tech stack? Like, can our stuff even work in your environment? Usually there's a bit of probing around the actual problem to make sure that it is a problem that we can solve and they're an appropriate lead for us in the first place. So this light qualification happens. And then it gets passed over to an AE. We book, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, and we're going to do what we call a first substantive sales call. So this is the first call. So what has not happened in the pre-qualification step is we have not done discovery. We've not done discovery. Now, what's discovery versus qualification? Well, we've talked about this before. Like, discovery is a little bit deeper. That's where we're getting into what's your exact situation? What are the constraints you have around this, this solution? What other things have you tried? What are you doing today? Are there things on your short list that we should know about or we would like to know about that we need to position against? We'll be getting into things like, you know, are there very, very specific requirements from an IT perspective, security, compliance, all that kind of stuff that we can't really dig into that until we're having a substantive conversation with the customer. So that needs to happen on the first call. That is a big chunk of what we're trying to get done on a first substantive call, is really understand what the customer situation is so that we can have a good substantive conversation later about how we fit that. Now, if that's happening in the first call, like, can we customize what we're saying in that first call to match that? Well, no, we can't, because we didn't find it out. Like, we literally just found it out at the beginning of this call, people. So we can't expect that the back half of that call or the part of the call where we're talking about our stuff is going to be customized. That's not how this works. If we think about it this way, that a first call, there's two big things that are happening there. So on the one side, we're getting deep on the customer's situation. We're doing deep, deep discovery so that we really understand what the customer needs, what their requirements are, what they're trying to get accomplished, what does success look like for them. At the same time, we are trying to give them a good understanding of our value, and in particular, our value versus other things that they might be considering. Our job on the first call is to do both of these things simultaneously in a good back and forth conversation. We cannot customize that yet because we're still figuring it out in the conversation itself. So I think there is a huge difference, particularly if we're talking about enterprise software, between what gets done in a first call and what happens in subsequent calls. Now that we've done discovery and we understand the customer situation and we understand what they want, in a second call, we can get very customized. We can address any of their deeper requests or things that they need to understand. We can bring in the right people from our side. They can bring in the right people from their side to get all of the stuff they need to get addressed. But first, we got to make it to the second call. And so in order to make it to the second call, we need to be able to put our best foot forward. and be really clear about the communication of this is what our differentiated value is. This is what we can do for you, and convince them that we're a good fit for them so that they agree to come and do the second call with us and don't immediately eliminate us in the first call. So I think it is unrealistic to think that every single call we do is going to be totally customized. Yes, things that happen after the first call are going to be very, very customized. But the world-class companies that I work for, typically those companies are very, very, very consistent about the way that they communicate value and position their product relative to competitors in the space on the first call. And they do that in a very consistent way that even a very new junior sales rep could show up, do discovery, do that good positioning, get it done on the first call so that we get permission to go ahead and move to the second call. So that's the first thing. I don't think we need to fully customize what happens in the first call. And in fact, the world-class companies that I see do not do that. There is a set pitch, which is a first call pitch. And that pitch is designed, one, to help the rep do good discovery, and two, to communicate our differentiated value so that we get permission from the customer to keep going in a conversation to move this thing towards a deal. So number two, the reason why positioning doesn't make the jump from marketing to sales, well, the obvious reason is because sales never agreed with the positioning in the first place. This happens a lot, like more than you would think, that marketing creates positioning in their own little bubble according to a lot of times that positioning is built based on some kind of research that the marketing team has. Now, often that research will include customer research that they've done. So, you know, maybe the marketing team has done win-loss analysis. Maybe they've done their own customer interviews, but it's also including things like market research and what they see from analyst groups and other things that they read on the internet, that kind of stuff. And so the marketing team will then build this positioning. They will then put it into a deck. They will send that deck over to sales and say, this is the positioning. You should be communicating this in your calls with customers. And sales looks at it and says, nah, I don't think so. And then it doesn't get used. It's just that simple. Sometimes the reason that sales does not agree with the positioning is because they don't understand it. So marketing has created something with a bunch of value props in it. Sales might be looking at it and they might be thinking, I don't agree with that. That's not what I hear when I'm talking to customers. Sometimes it's something as simple as language. They're looking at the language and they're like, I don't understand that language. I don't really know what those terms mean. I don't know what you mean. Like, you know, marketing, we have a tendency to use some terms that people don't always understand or agree with. But regardless, often what you'll get is sales will look at it. They don't understand it. So they're just not going to use it because they don't understand it. Sometimes sales looks at it and they just plain disagree. So what they see in the positioning doesn't actually match with what they see with prospects. So they're looking at the positioning and they're saying, I know why a customer buys and this ain't it. Or your number three is my number one. My number two doesn't even show up on your list. I don't agree with this. And I think it's risky for me to use this positioning because it might not get me deals. The obvious way we fix this is we have sales involved in doing the positioning work itself. Now, there's lots of advantages in having sales be involved in our positioning work. We desperately need to know what's happening in a typical sales process. I mean, think about it, that nobody on the team anywhere inside the company has as much customer experience as sales does. And it's not just customer experience, it's they are working with a customer as the customer is going through an actual purchase process. Like, that's amazing information. And yet often what you'll see, again, is marketing developing positioning without really getting the salesperson's input at all. So I think we want the salespeople to be involved because they come with a lot of good information that is actually going to make our positioning better. The second reason we want them involved is the more involved they are in creating the positioning, the more they're going to understand it. The more they understand it, the more they're going to be able to use it when it actually comes to doing sales calls. So I think if we want positioning to make the jump from marketing and sales, second thing is we need to have sales involved in doing it. The third reason why I think positioning doesn't make the jump from marketing and sales is more the way the positioning is packaged up. Often what I'll see is the marketing team will build a first call pitch deck, or sometimes worse, they'll go to an agency and the agency will build a first call pitch deck. And if you look at the people in that agency, there are no salespeople among them. They're all marketing people. So we have marketing people. They're building this, what they consider to be an excellent sales deck. Again, they're doing this without a lot of input from the sales team. They're heaving it over the wall to the sales team. And the sales team, even if they agree with the positioning, even if they like some of the wording in there, the way it's packaged up into a pitch deck doesn't do what the sales team needs it to do. So as I talked about in the first point, one of the key things we need to do in a first call is discovery. A lot of these pitch decks that I see, there is no obvious spot for a rep to do discovery if you look at the actual flow of the pitch deck itself. So what that means is that the rep is going to have to do discovery outside of the structure of the pitch. And it, like, think about that. Like, discovery is one of the key things we're trying to do in the first call. If you go and tell the reps, okay, look, like, you know, discovery, that's just some weird sales thing you're going to do. So just get that done first and then move over to the actual pitch. That doesn't make any sense. What will happen in practice is that the sales team will start with discovery. It will feel like an interrogation to the prospect. This discovery, think about it, if it goes well, it naturally evolves into a conversation about our product and what we can do and what we do relative to other people. And then you could easily see how a salesperson would then kind of look at the pitch deck and say, well, how do I then segue back into this pitch deck? It doesn't really make any sense. So what happens is they're doing discovery. The bulk of the first call conversation is happening in this discovery thing. And then maybe we switch over to, okay, now let's give you a demo and we'll give you the product walkthrough demo. And there'll be no positioning happening in that. So you can see if the pitch deck doesn't actually take into account the fact that the rep is going to have to do discovery, then the pitch deck is probably not going to get used, or it's not going to get used in the form that it's in. It's not just discovery that the marketers tend to leave out. There's a lot of other things like objection handling, for example. A good rep will naturally be handling objections throughout the sales pitch as they come up. So if people ask a question and say, hey, well, why wouldn't I just do that this way? Or, hey, doesn't that mean this? Or, hey, that sounds complicated. Can you explain what that is? Obviously, the rep's going to do that as the pitch goes along. But very often, we will have what we call an unspoken objection. Now, unspoken objection typically falls into one or two different categories. One, it'll be about pricing, like the prospect might be thinking in their mind, well, that all sounds really good, but that sounds like it would be really expensive. It sounds kind of enterprising. Maybe that's not for us. And often a prospect will not bring that up because they figure they're not going to get pricing out of you anyway in a first call or whatever, or they don't want to kind of admit that they don't have the budget for that, or they don't even know how to ask about pricing. Then they're worried that the rep will just take that as a signal to, you know, dig deeper into stuff they don't want to talk about, or who knows what. So pricing is often an unspoken objection. The other thing that's often an unspoken objection is a whole can of worms around change management. So this sounds very exciting and great, but man, that sounds like a big hassle. That sounds like a lot of change for the organization. I don't know how we're going to manage that change. That means we're going to have to rip out all kinds of stuff, replace it with all kinds of stuff. This thing is a non-starter. That is also often an unspoken objection. A really good sales pitch has specific places in the pitch to handle that unspoken objection. Again, often if we've got the agency doing the pitch deck or the marketing team alone doing the pitch deck, they don't know what the unspoken objection is, so they don't bake that into the pitch deck itself. A really good pitch deck that's been done in concert with sales will often have some of these big unspoken objections addressed. Like pricing, for example, even if we don't know enough to give a customer an exact price in a first call, we could discuss the pricing model, which the customer could use to kind of get a ballpark idea of what pricing might be like, even if we're not prepared to discuss pricing. If we are prepared to discuss pricing, then let's put it in there and let's have that discussion. The other thing about change management is often companies have done all kinds of smart things to make sure that the change management is not so painful. So we have a section in the pitch deck to address that, that says, look, you know, we're talking about a full-blown project here. We often break those projects up into stages. Here's what the stages look like. Here's the training we're going to get you. We have a professional services team. Here's how they're going to work with you. Here's how we're going to manage this change process. No problem. Typically, it takes a couple of weeks, not a couple of months. Anyways, there's a spot in the pitch deck to specifically address those unspoken objections. So again, I think, you know, number three point here is often the positioning doesn't make the jump from marketing to sales because the deck itself or the way the positioning is packaged up doesn't actually meet the needs of a sales rep in a first call situation. And they end up kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater because they're like, look, I've got this set of things I need to get done on this call. The structure of this deck doesn't actually help me do that. Therefore, I'm just not going to use it at all, or I'm going to modify it to the point that you don't even recognize the thing 2 months down the road. The last reason why I think positioning does not make the jump from marketing and sales comes from this false belief, and typically this would come from the marketing team, that every persona involved in getting a deal done needs separate positioning and therefore their own sort of weird spin on a pitch deck. So what we'll end up with is multiple pitch decks for the multiple stakeholders involved in getting a deal done. This, I think, is probably the most, I see this a lot, particularly in enterprise deals where there are a large number of stakeholders involved in a deal. So we all know the research on this, depending on which research you believe, a typical B2B purchase process involves 5 to 11 decision makers on a team. This is one of the big reasons why B2B is so much more complicated than B2C. B2C, we just have to sell to the end user, the actual person that's going to use the thing. Often in B2B, particularly in enterprise, there is a team of folks, end users will be involved, but there will also be a level of management above that. Typically the economic buyer, the person that writes the check, is a level above that. You will have other teams involved, like if we're selling into a line of business, the IT team will be involved to make sure that things work on the IT side. You might get legal involved. You might have a purchasing team that gets involved. There might be other departments that this deployment impacts, and there'll be representatives from those other departments. Sometimes we've got security, compliance, all kinds of things. And so there's a scraping team. And in order for a deal to get done, we have to get past all these people. Like all these people need to kind of come together and agree, yes, this is a good solution. And that's how the deal gets done. If you think about it, it's kind of amazing we actually get any deals done at all if you see how complicated it is, a typical B2B purchase process. Now, here's what I think about this. Often the team internally will have this idea, well, each of these stakeholders has very different things that they're worried about. So end users are very worried about the day-to-day. Is this thing easy to use? Is it annoying? Does it make my life better or worse on a day-to-day basis? End users have a very specific set of requirements and things that they're worried about because they're going to be the people using this thing day in, day out. IT, on the other hand, has their own set of requirements. It's all around, is this thing manageable? Does it integrate with all the other systems that we have? It's going to make my life a pain in the neck, you know, every day when I have to set this thing up and deploy things and upgrade it and all that other stuff. And then you've got purchasing is worried about, are we getting a good deal? Does this, you know, meet all of our requirements? You know, did we do a good process to choose the thing? All that sort of stuff. And then you've got legal and compliance have their own specific issues. Does this meet our compliance requirements? Does this meet our legal requirements? Often the financial buyer, the person writing the check, has bigger picture things that they're worried about. They're worried about, the overall long-term impact on the company. They often are worried about things like, is this project going to fail? If we make a decision to do that, does it actually impact other decisions we have? We might have big corporate objectives we're trying to meet, and the economic buyer is worried about how this aligns with the other bigger corporate objectives. So there's all these people and they all care about different things. Now, in a big B2B purchase, typically we have a person, and that person is often referred to as the champion. The champion is the person that kind of shepherds this deal along. Often the champion is not the economic buyer. Often what you have is the economic buyer has delegated making a recommendation to a person on their team. And they'll say, hey, go figure out what new ERP we should buy. You know, go look at it, come back, make a recommendation. If I like the recommendation, I'm the economic buyer, I'll sign off on it and we'll buy. Often that champion is like middle management, which means they're not the end user either. Sometimes they are, but often they're not. So they don't represent end users. They don't necessarily represent the economic buyer, but it is part of their job to get this team together and make sure we have agreement and alignment across all of the stakeholders. So if we think about this, a typical first call is done with the champion. It's actually kind of rare that we would have end users or IT, certainly not purchasing or compliance or legal. These people tend to get involved in the deal at the later stages. The initial set of calls is usually done with the champion, and the champion is doing an initial call with a bunch of different vendors to determine, well, you know, should this vendor stay on my short list? Should we move forward with doing some deeper exploration on this? And the champion's doing that on their own because they don't want to waste everybody else's time. It's either on their own. They might have one or two of the stakeholders involved really early if they're worried about them. But the champion is the person that is moving this deal along. The champion's the person that we have on the first call, and we got to get past the champion. Otherwise, we don't make it to the second call or the third call or any of the other calls where we're starting to get these other people involved. So if our positioning does not resonate for the champion, we're dead. We really need to get the champion on. So coming back to this idea that a pitch deck would need to be customized for every different persona that is involved in the deal, I just think doesn't make any sense. Because the pitch deck, the way I think about it, is a first call pitch deck. And so the first call pitch deck needs to be oriented to the champion. And then as we move along, it is our responsibility to, one, arm the champion to handle the objections of all these other stakeholders so that they can get agreement. And we can do that in a very specific, customized way because it is coming later on in the deal. So it actually wouldn't make sense for us to have a first call deck for IT or first call deck for end users or first call deck for the economic buyer if we're not doing a first call with any of those personas. So I don't think we need variations on a pitch deck for every single persona that we might encounter in the course of getting this deal done. I think first call pitch deck, we need to really understand who is the persona of our champion, and then let's really nail the pitch deck for the champion, and then we'll worry about arming the champion to handle the objections of everybody else as the deal moves along, if we're lucky enough to get the deal to move along. Anyway, so that's it. I hope you folks thought that was helpful. It's a lot of these things I think are easily fixed. One, by just getting sales more involved in the process of doing positioning and creating the sales pitch deck. I think the more we have input from sales, the better all that stuff gets. And the more sales is involved, the more likely it is that sales is going to actually use the stuff after we have created it. That's it for today. Listen, thanks for showing up. There's a handful of things I'd like to talk about right at the end. So one is, I don't know if I mentioned that the audiobook for my latest book, Sales Pitch, is actually available now. You can find it on Audible or anywhere else that you get your audiobooks. There's an audiobook for the first book as well, obviously awesome. It's interesting to me. A lot of the folks that read my stuff will do audiobook and paper version of the book together or audiobook and ebook together. It's fascinating to me. Anyways, I hated recording those audiobooks. It's a real pain in the ass to do it. So yeah, but if you're into audiobooks, man, I did it for you. So check that out. And the second thing is that I am writing a newsletter at this point. So if you folks are interested in written content in addition to this kind of podcasty stuff, then you can check that out. The last thing I'm going to tell you is that this is season two of the podcast. Things are going to run a little bit differently this time around. I found doing weekly episodes was a bit too much for me, given how busy that I am on the consulting side of things right now. So I'm going to go a little bit with episodes that run every other week. The other thing I think you're going to see in season two is a bit more emphasis on guests. I specifically didn't do a lot of guests in season one because I had a lot of deep thinking that I wanted to get out on specific positioning topics that I didn't necessarily have a guest that I could call on for us to have a discussion about that. This time around, I think I'm going to pull in some guests. I'm going to have a few CEOs that have done work with me that I think are really good positioning thinkers. I'm also going to bring in some experts and consultants that can go really deep on aspects of things related to doing positioning, building a sales pitch, all that other stuff. So I hope you follow along and I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks. Bye.